Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new Louisiana law that requires sex offenders and child predators to register their criminal status on Facebook and other social networking profiles is just the latest in a growing trend of social media crime and crime prevention. Here to talk about how social media creates new opportunities for crime and crime prevention is Alex Kirkpatrick, a reporter for Mashable. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So social media and crime, once again, Louisiana has a new law in place. It requires sex offenders and child predators to include their criminal status on their Facebook and other social networking sites. And now Facebook says it already bans registered sex offenders from creating profiles. So what's the goal of the Louisiana legislation?
The goal of Louisiana legislation was to start the conversation about sex offenders and Facebook. It goes into effect August 1st and has people that are registered sex offenders in the state of Louisiana. It forces them to put their status on their Facebook profile for, I guess, all the world to see.
Okay, so what information do they need to include if they were to do that? And I was wondering how many people have actually done it.
Yeah, absolutely. The law says that sex offenders have to include the nature of the crime for which they were convicted, the jurisdiction, the area where they were convicted in, a description of what they look like, and a residential address with their profile, within their profile, rather. So that goes well and beyond what many people put on their Facebook profile as public information.
Well, how do they enforce it?
You know, I'm honestly not sure how they enforce it, to be honest.
And how many do we know, or do you have any sense about how many people that qualify for that requirement are doing it?
No, because it hasn't gone into effect yet.
All right.
August 1st.
All right. Well, what any sense of expectations? I mean, were there any naysayers?
A bunch of privacy groups, came to the fold to say that it steps over some privacy bounds. But beyond that, not really. Most people, I think, consider that a fairly good idea. As you know, registered sex offenders already exist, have to register in online directories so that people in a certain area can determine, you know, which of them lives near them and all sorts of things like that. So information about them is already freely available online. This just puts it in a place where a lot of people go.
Facebook says it already bans registered sex offenders from creating profiles. Is that the case? And how so? How do they do that?
That's the case, and it's a matter of scanning profiles for information that would reveal them to be sex offenders and that are registered in other databases. Obviously, people can get around that by registering with fake names and fake information, et cetera. So that's sort of an ongoing battle between Facebook's employees and security staff and anybody that wants to register that isn't allowed to register on Facebook by the company.
I guess the idea is to prevent predators and other criminals from using Facebook as a vehicle to continue committing crime. But so it makes me wonder how many people would actually put their real name on it in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, many people do put their real name on Facebook.
Because they want other people to find them.
Exactly. That's the idea. The social network is, there are some social networks that can be anonymous, but Facebook is really about putting your real name on there for the most part. I know some people change their names when they're applying for a job to avoid their employer finding them and other things like that. But as far as sexual predators go, if we're talking about people who go after underage kids, because of U.S. law, you have to be at least 13 years old to start a profile on the site. There have been cases of children getting their profiles shut down because they found to be younger than that. But it's generally a good practice. If you're a parent with a young teenager or a younger child who wants to start a Facebook profile, if you're going to let them do that, it's probably a good idea to make sure that all of their information is kept private and they're only using it to interact with friends and whatnot, not putting their information publicly available, especially their pictures.
We have an email from a listener. By the way, if you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Fitzpatrick. He's a reporter for Mashable, and we're talking about social media and crime prevention. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. From a listener, says, my question is, if you suspect that someone you know may be an online child predator, what, if anything, can be done about this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. If you go to Facebook, if you go to a person's profile, you can. There's an option to flag that profile for various reasons, whether they're you think they're you suspect them of criminal activity, or if they're if you suspect them of being a spam account, all sorts of things. And then from there, Facebook will take it and assess if that profile should be deleted, if it violates their terms of service and whatnot, and go from there. There's also email addresses from Facebook that you can contact. We've help@facebook.com might be one of them. But if you go to Facebook, upper right corner, there's a down arrow. You can click help, and there is information within there on doing those things.
Is there any indication that Facebook is the primary modus operandi, or is Twitter seeing some problems with this, or are there suspected problems with it, or other social networking sites?
I would say that every social networking site has an issue with this, particularly ones that might cater towards the younger audience. If, again, we're talking about sexual predators and underage children. Mm-hmm. But I think Facebook is really the one that everybody's familiar with because it's the one that almost everybody has. It's the one that it's a social network that's the most ubiquitous. So it's really it's the target of, people, criminals go where people are, I suppose. So it makes sense for them to be there.
Facebook, we said, monitors for sex offenders, but it monitors chats for criminal activity as well, right?
It does, yes. There's a recent Reuters report that revealed a few more details than the company's ever revealed before about their practice of monitoring chats for various criminal activity, whether that's sexual predation, illicit gun sales, et cetera. The company's really hush-hush with those details, but they do monitor certain chats. But they basically have a two-step process. There's a filter that looks for certain keywords and other details that might reveal that something fishy is going on. And then if that software red flags something it suspects of being criminal behavior, then a human security employee at Facebook will take a look and say, okay, yeah, we should call the police about this.
Are there any examples that we know of that where they have busted somebody?
There's none so far that we know that they've monitored chats and that's led to a conviction of anybody. Mm-hmm. But they certainly have the police in various places around the world have requested user information from Facebook and Twitter and other social media companies. And those two companies have cooperated with law enforcement in the past.
Is that like a police subpoena?
It is, yes.
And Facebook does how do they balance then this invasion of privacy with what they're doing?
It's a great question. It's a lot about they're open. If you look at their terms of service, it says that, we'll cooperate with law enforcement requests, et cetera. Twitter in particular has come step up to the plate really well in protecting users' privacy when it comes to police subpoenas. There's one or a couple really good cases where the Manhattan district attorney wanted Twitter data from people who were involved with Occupy Wall Street who were arrested on this big protest across the Brooklyn Bridge. And Twitter stepped up and said, we can't do that. You have to get that from the Twitter users themselves. We won't provide it to you, et cetera. But eventually they were superseded and lost that case. But they did make a pretty big statement out of, we're going to fight for our users' privacy when we see fit.
When they were superseded, was it on the basis of the fact that they can subpoena phone records and utility bill records and that sort of thing? So why not Twitter and Facebook?
Essentially, yes. It has to do with the Wiretap Act and whether or not Twitter is seen as a communications device or a broadcasting system. Mm-hmm. So there's a pretty fine legal argument to make there, as well as whether or not the Twitter user themselves own tweets or the Twitter, the company, owns tweets. That was also disputed in the case.
So when police do subpoena Facebook info or Twitter info, what do they get?
Well, it depends on what they're looking for and how much information that those companies provide. I was writing about the Facebook story that you brought up. I was looking at a request that was granted by Facebook to Boston Police that included the IP address of the user, which is sort of your computer's identification on the internet, mm-hmm. As well as photos that were posted by that user, much of his wall posts, all sorts of things that you could probably get most of his email address. You can get a lot of that by just looking at a Facebook profile page, but to bring it into court and to get those IP numbers really does confirm that it's the person that's being prosecuted in court.
There's a new initiative called Crowdsourced Investigations. It was inspired in part by a Mashable article. Tell us about what inspired it and what it is.
Absolutely. Crowdsourced Investigations is a platform that the person behind it believes that, you know, people are separated by crime. It's sort of like the rule of Kevin Bacon. Everybody is separated from Kevin Bacon by, what is it, 6 degrees, 7 degrees? Mm-hmm. I forgot. But he believes that everybody's separated from a crime by only a few degrees. So if we can use this incredible network of social media, both Facebook and Twitter and other platforms, to advertise, hey, there's been a crime. This is what we know. This is the description we have. Has anybody seen this person, or does anybody know anything more? Was anybody there? And we can go off and maybe find some more details that way. It's especially interesting when you bring in geolocation, which is the idea that your mobile phone knows where you are. Mm-hmm. So if we can specifically target people that were in a certain area at a certain time near where a crime took place, the odds are pretty good maybe that we can find somebody who knows something about a crime that was committed. And it gets especially interesting when you look at Reddit is a social network where a lot of people gather together to post usually funny videos and stuff like that, but they also talk about current events. And what happened on Friday with the tragic shooting in Colorado is that a Denver resident hopped on Reddit and posted, hey, there's been a shooting, this is what I know. And then everybody who knew anything about the shooting started to craft this really amazing crowdsourced timeline about the events that took place, where they took place, photos, video taken from the scene and whatnot. And while there were certainly holes in that, and they couldn't independently confirm anything, mm-hmm. The same way a journalist might, you know, that timeline, that crowdsourced timeline, plus the professional journalism that was coming out, filled gaps for each other, and in total, and some created a really interesting and complete picture of what was going on as much as we knew at that point on Friday.
When you're crowdsourcing something, you have to have a fulcrum. I mean, you have to have a common denominator, right?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you need to all be looking at the same thing and some way to, whether there's a hashtag or whatever it might be.
Yes, exactly.
How do they get to where they know, how do you know that?
How do you know
what it's going to be? Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's a really interesting, I'm not exactly sure how it happens, but it does happen very organically where mm-hmm. Usually it's the first few people that tweet out about an event. We use a few different hashtags. Like on Friday morning, we saw Batman, hashtag Batman shooting, hashtag theater shooting,
yeah.
hashtag Aurora. And whichever one kind of people sort of flock to one that makes sense and then kind of go from there, and it grows organically and people sort of implicitly agree this is what we're using.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't remember Aurora, but I could remember Batman. That's what I went to.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where I found everything. Well, Alex Fitzpatrick, thanks for joining us again today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Alex Fitzpatrick is a reporter for Mashable. Coming up, we're going to talk about cameras. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
World markets took a beating Monday, and the euro slid to a two-year low against the dollar. Amid the dizzying statistics, Walter Russell Mead argues the crisis rises beyond economics. Politically, he says, Turkey, Asia, NATO, the U.S., pretty much everybody's a loser. I'm Neil Conan, the fallout from the euro crisis, plus Michel Flournoy on the president's foreign policy. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 here on 89.7 NPR News. And tonight on WOSU-TV, watch the latest installment of History Detectives. One investigator floors country music singer Clint Black with information she uncovers about his turn of the 20th century Book of Wanted posters. Then can a chunk of molten metal be linked to a B-25 bomber that crashed into the Empire State Building? Finally, a 6-foot metal bar tells the story behind the original iconic Hollywood sign. Watch History Detectives. It's tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. Scattered showers and thunderstorms and 78 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today with rain off and on throughout the day, a high near 87. There's a chance of rain tonight, a chance of rain decreasing, though, a low of 64 degrees. Isolated showers still possible with a high of 90 degrees for tomorrow. Cloudy skies tomorrow night, a low of 72. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, if you're wondering why we had that lengthy interlude of our theme music, by the way, composed by Alan DiCenzo, it's because our regularly scheduled guest is not available for some reason. We don't know why, but pinch hitting for us is Russell Holley. Welcome to the show, Russell.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine, you're in your car, but we appreciate your help. Better than nothing. It's pretty bad, though. We may have to. Russell, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Fine.
Yeah, we can't hear you, though, so I don't think it's going to work. I think I'll have to say goodbye. Hopefully you're someplace in about 20 minutes where we can talk to you better. Okay. That was Russell Holley. Hopefully he'll be joining us in about 15 minutes. And I'm still looking for my regularly scheduled guest who is not here. And we're sorry to hear that. But if you want to talk about anything technical, I cannot answer your questions, but we can start to accumulate them for Russell Holley when he does join us in about 15 minutes. On the other hand, we have about 20 minutes to talk about anything you want. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to continue our conversation from earlier today about the American way of eating. We talked with Tracy McMillan. If you want to continue that conversation, I'd be happy to do that because then I could always talk about food. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides Facebook page and post your question or comment there. I'm all ears if you want to talk about food. Coming up, we were going to talk about cameras and taking pictures with smartphones. If you have any suggestions about taking pictures with smartphones, give us a call. Love to hear your ideas because we don't have any other ideas to talk about. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I guarantee you give me a call right now, I'll put you on the air because I need to. Unless you want to listen to me talk. Oh, here come the phones. Stay with us. We want to get to all your calls. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. We have a little bit of a mini open forum right now because we had a cancellation apparently. And we'd love to hear from you. Beth, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm better now that you're on the air with me.
That's terrible.
That's okay. It's live radio.
I do have a tech question for Russell, but
We'll save that one. Yeah,
I'll save it. Well, it's really interesting that that topic would be brought up because I just was on a vacation with my family in Vermont, and we were talking about how over the top Vermont has gotten with sustainable this and sustainable that and this, that, and the other, and it's just kind of like, you know, roll your eyes. But one of the things that's slowly coming to Columbus that is part of the, you know, the food, you know, healthy food for all movement, where I used to live, is allowing people to use their EBT cards to get food at the farmer's market.
These would be what we consider food stamps and other...
Right.
Right, right.
Right. And I don't think that there's enough that's being done to really talk about that and benefits of that in the community or in underserved communities. But also, you know, there's the 4th Street Project where they're teaching kids and adults how to grow, you know, do container planning and, you know, grow where you got it and I know that Clintonville Community Center has a little garden growing right next to the cornerstone.
And then you have to teach people how to cook it.
Exactly. That's what Anthony Bourdain said in Medium Raw, because he is like the most, one of the biggest advocates for, you know, food equality. And he goes on about this love-hate relationship that he has with Alice Waters. And well, she's kind of an interesting person.
Who's sort of considered the founder of the organic food movement.
Right. She's quite the walking contradiction. And but at the same time, you know, while she comes off as this total food snob, she also started a garden project at Martin Luther King Junior High, where the kids not only learned how to where their food came from, they had to cook it and put it together and serve it, and then they sell some of their proceeds to the local chef.
I assume this is in San Francisco, right?
Berkeley.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Say, you know, Beth, I don't want to interrupt you, but I do want to tell people that we are doing a live remote at the Columbus Health Department's opening farmers market on August 2nd.
Okay.
And we do talk about using the cards, the food stamp cards, for lack of a better, just so people know what we're talking about, and how that's increasingly popular and it is getting around. So if people want to join us out at the Columbus Health Department on Parsons on August 2nd, that would be great. It's open to all.
Okay. Well,
all right.
Great talking to you.
All right.
Okay.
You too, Beth. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Giovanni in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
How are you today, Ann?
I'm good. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you.
You want to talk about food, too?
I do. I'm a local restaurant consultant, and I've owned restaurants in Cleveland, and I owned a food truck here in Columbus for a while. And I think it's really important for people to look at the way that the market, especially in a city like Columbus, where it's a test market to a large scale, drives the way that people eat and the way that people cook here.
How does that work? How does it do it?
Well, if you have your grocery stores as a staple, that's obviously where most people get their food. When this food is mass-produced and mass-marketed to people, those are the options that they have as far as what they're able to cook. Obviously, your skill level with cooking comes into that, but if they were to be able to open up to things like farmers market, and if the USDA was able to open up the lines of communication for bringing into the cities that had a different quality and a variety of different foods, you're able to teach people with that method to eat better just naturally through that process, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So what we end up having is that, you know, a lot of the grocery stores have very similar items, so you find people eating a very similar way. And those people that are more prone to cook at home than to eat out are looking to have a better variety of food for themselves, but when they don't find that in their store, then they're relegated to cooking what they're able to find. And by and large, the people that don't cook at home are finding themselves with less options as far as eating out. If you go to a chain restaurant, Fridays, things like that in Columbus, you'll find that a lot of the items that are on the menu are similar between restaurant groups.
Right. And, you know, as well, when you're talking about the same things in all the grocery stores, some people, the casual listener might say, what are you, insane? I mean, the grocery stores are bigger than ever. There's a million things to pick from, but there's actually fewer things to pick from.
I absolutely agree.
I think it's Michael Pollan wrote about it. There's not as many choices.
And you find that there's a lot of other states. I came to Columbus from Oregon. And in those states, you'll find that your grocery stores have a better relationship with small farms and with organic producers and co-ops. And that brings not only a better variety of food to the table, but it brings a lot higher quality product. And people are willing to pay more for those if they know that they're not going to be inundated with chemicals and mass processed foods and things like that.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good day.
Take care. You too. Lance in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Lance.
Yes. Oh, thank you. I'm retired, fixed income, low income, and I'm mostly a vegetables and fruit guy because it's a much simpler way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't buy absolutely fresh vegetables. I buy mostly frozen vegetables because they keep forever. And when you prepare them, all you have to do is thaw them out with warm water from the faucet. I don't even cook them, but I do rewash them. And in washing them with a warm faucet water, why they thaw out very nicely, and I eat them straight with rarely ever, if I wanted to steam them a little bit, I might put some boiling water in with it. But basically, they're very fresh, very easy to keep. And my refrigerator is not stocked with absolutely fresh. The only fresh things that I might buy are the spinach leaves, which I wash and then sprinkle throughout the salad for interest. And I eat a lot of apples and long-lasting fruits that stay in the refrigerator. So I'm able to live fairly economically, despite what people say that it costs more money. I find it doesn't. It's actually saving money if I stick to the frozen vegetables, which are so easy to prepare, and they're often fresher than the fresh vegetables that have been weeks in shipping. The frozen vegetables are fast frozen within hours after picking, so they're much likelier to be fresh.
Why do you think you've been able to maintain this kind of discipline about your diet despite your lower income? Were you raised with fresh vegetables, and that's just something you really like to stick with? Is it something that was in part of your lifestyle before?
I'm 80 years old. I was raised during the Depression. We always seem to have tripe and brains and lots of meat, lots of hamburger and so forth. We ate lots of meat, but it wasn't, toxic meat. It was all sort of grange meat. But we always had our vegetables, and it was forbidden to leave your plate unclean. You had to eat everything because the poor Chinese were starving.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are with all this wealth of food during the Depression. So I was raised half vegetarian, half carnivore. Mm-hmm. But throughout the years, I find it's much easier, much healthier to live mostly a vegetarian fruit diet. It simplifies things so much. I get my protein from nuts and seeds, and I do buy canned beans that last for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the same as the beans you might cook at home. So I save on cooking that way by getting my protein occasionally through canned beans, which are very easy to fix. Mm-hmm. I don't even bother to heat them up sometimes. I'll just put them right in with the salads.
Well, thanks for all your tips, Lance. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Eric in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hey, Ann. Nice to meet you.
Thank
First
you.
First-time caller.
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to say real quick, your first guest, that was a really fascinating interview.
The crime in technology or the last hour?
Oh, the last hour with the food industry.
Yeah, yeah. Tracy McMullen, yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
Thank you.
She mentioned Foxconn, which some people may be familiar with, and that kind of leads into what I wanted to bring up, which was technological unemployment. And, you know, Foxconn is, some of their workers are committing suicides because they're so stressed out and overworked and underpaid. And
well, tell us what Foxconn is first.
Foxconn is a company that makes, like, computer parts for Apple
in China,
like that. Exactly.
Yeah, right.
In the Shenzhen area.
Yeah.
And so a lot of their workers are, I shouldn't say a lot. Some of the workers were committing suicide and it had become a problem. And one of the things Foxconn is doing to kind of deal with this problem is automating many of its jobs. If you Google Foxconn, you can see some of the articles And I think by 2014 or 15, they plan on installing a million new robots to displace humans so they don't have to deal with the suicide issue. And obviously, that brings up a lot of other issues, unemployment and whatnot. But if you look at the growth of technology, it's exponential. And even in America, you have fully automated factories where, you know, it's kind of displacing people at a accelerating rate. And you know, that's been covered on NPR a little bit here and there with Tom Ashbrook. But if you read some of the books, it's really fascinating. And it seems like one of those fundamental changes where, you know, we have an economy based on work for income. And as technology continues to displace workers, then, you know, that paradigm kind of is disruptive. So I don't know. It's very interesting stuff.
Well, it could displace workers in traditional jobs, but couldn't it also create jobs?
Exactly. So it depends on the rate. And if there's a quote by John Maynard Keynes, and it's when jobs being displaced is outpacing jobs being created, and then you have a problem. And if you look at some of the work by Ray Kurzweil, he talks about exponential technological growth. And so it seems that maybe at some point in the future, of course, we could continue to invent jobs, you know, probably indefinitely, but they, you know, may not be necessary. There may be a tipping point where our technology is advancing faster and faster. And then, you know, automation is doing so much of the things we used to do that, you know, perhaps we should ask ourselves, you know, is a 40-hour work week going to be indefinite? Should that change? Or, you know, just very, very kind of
pretty fundamental questions. Yeah.
So our economy may be changing like very rapidly, and you don't see it talked about too much in the mainstream. But, you know, with higher unemployment, you kind of have to question that, and stagnant wages, you kind of have to, you know, all these things kind of like come into play.
We were talking about that last week on a program. You know, there's the slow food movement and there's the slow economy movement now, where one way to rectify or to address that issue is to make sure you're taking care of your local economy first.
Indeed.
Buying local is kind of an oversimplification, but there's a lot of other ways to do it. And big companies can do it just as much as small companies. In terms of what good is it having a factory in the middle of a city when no one can afford to, you know, live anywhere near you, and you can't afford to pay people to work there because you're shipping out all your jobs overseas.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think localization is obviously key, but, you know, as your guest in the first hour mentioned, you know, if you don't have access to those things, if they're local but they're out of reach for, you know, many of the people or under-income people, then it's a problem. So, yeah, access, I guess, is a big issue as well.
Well, Eric, thanks for giving us a call.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
No problem.
Everybody, thanks for all your calls. We appreciate it. It was fun to continue the conversation about the American way of eating. It's the book by Tracy McMillan. We talked about it last hour. When we return, we will return with Russell Holley of Geek.com, and it will Tech Tuesday will return as well. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of America's 30-year conflict with Iran. We talk with David Crist about his new book, The Twilight War, based on hundreds of interviews and on documents he got released through the Freedom of Information Act. Crist himself observed a close call while serving with special ops forces. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 73 degrees with some light rain and some showers in and around downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day, and cloudy skies, a high near 87 today. Still a slight chance of rain for tonight, a low of 64 degrees. Isolated showers are still possible for tomorrow, a high around 90. Clouds tomorrow night, a low of 72.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. Information about how Montgomery & Associates can help you achieve your financial goals is at themontgomerysolution.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
All right, back to Tech Tuesday. Advances in computing technology inevitably lead to advances in viruses and malware. Thankfully, antivirus software continues to advance as well, but with so many different types of antivirus software out there, which programs offer the best protection for the best cost? Joining us to share his personal advice regarding antivirus software is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
I was going to say, wait a minute. No pauses. All right, so Russell, computer viruses are always a problem, but sometimes they're hard to detect with the naked eye. That's where the antivirus software comes in. Do most antivirus programs detect viruses and actually protect your computer from them?
So there's really three different kinds of antivirus software that's kind of out and about right now. You've got kind of free antivirus software that you know is offered that covers all of the basic stuff. You know, you've got things that are out there that have been out there for a little while that all of these companies are aware of, and these tools help you take care of the really obvious things that have been troubling us for a while. They're not as up to date, but they work really well for some of the basic obvious stuff, like when you accidentally click on a link in your email or something like that. And the one that I think is the best for that particular category is actually made by Microsoft. It's Windows Defender. And it's free to anybody. As long as you have a Windows computer, it works just fine. And all you have to do is just, you know, go right to Microsoft's website. Windows Defender is incredibly easy to install, and it's free and covers all of the basic stuff.
So beyond that?
What you really have to look at from that point is you have to consider how new your computer is and how much you're willing to pay on a regular basis for it. There's the software that comes with all the bells and whistles. You have stuff from Norton and McAfee that they don't just come with antivirus software anymore. They do so many different things. They do phishing protection. They have pop-up blockers. They have, you know, things that scan your email for you. There are tons and tons and tons of features in each one of these, but they require a constant connection to the internet, and they run at very specific times of the day. It's very much a clockwork-oriented system, where as long as it keeps running and keeps updating, then the system runs really, really well. And you will wind up paying anywhere between $40 and $70 a year for those kind of services. And generally speaking, they're very effective. You know, there's a lot of people who run into problems with one antivirus software or another, and they bounce back and forth, but really a lot of these guys, especially when you talk about Norton and McAfee, they offer a lot of very similar services.
Okay, so what are some indicators that your computer might be infected with a virus? How do you know, or is it by that time, is it like some of those bad cancers, it's too late by the time you know you have it?
Really, if you know that you have something, if something's wrong with your computer, you turn your computer on and you've got pop-ups coming up all over the place that shouldn't, or you know, things that really just kind of look like obvious scams, it's probably too late at that point, and you need to have the machine either professionally cleaned by antivirus, you know, professionals at either Staples or Best Buy or something like that, or you need to look towards just starting over new and just, you know, reinstalling your operating system. Reinstalling your operating system, if you've got your files backed up somewhere using either a cloud service like we've talked about before, or an external hard drive, those things are not as difficult to do anymore. A lot of that stuff is very much, you know, you put the disk in and Windows will walk you through a lot of reinstalling. So if you feel like you've just gone too far, or you don't want to pay some of the kind of crazy fees that some of these guys will charge for antivirus software, then you're probably better off that way. But really, if you see, you know, anything that just kind of strikes you as really odd, especially after you've done something, you know, like accidentally click a link in an email, or if one of your kids has been using Facebook or MySpace and now you're getting pop-ups all over the place, that's generally warnings that, you know, things have gone too far.
What kind of viruses and malware are there? There's the Trojan horses, spyware viruses. What's the difference between all of them? Are they all sort of trying to do the same thing in different ways?
There are a lot of them that occupy different purposes, and really, there are so many that I could probably talk for an hour about what each one of the different ones do and why they're different. But the big things to keep in mind is that there are the nastiest kind of virus right now is the kind that slips into your computer, and instead of doing damage to your computer, actually uses your computer, by which I mean, you know, your processor, your hard drive, and your internet connection to do damage to other computers. These are more commonly referred to as botnets, and really what they do is it creates a network of other people's computers to go in and do all this dirty work for you, so that when people at Norton and McAfee and Kaspersky and these places finally track the location of the virus down, they run into, you know, the house of somebody whose computer is on all the time, but they probably only use it for about an hour a day to check their email and stuff like that. And while it's not being used to check email, that computer can be doing a whole lot of other nasty things.
You mentioned Microsoft Windows Defender. It's a free option. There's also Microsoft Security Essentials. What's the difference?
So Microsoft Security Essentials and Microsoft Defender are going to be the same thing as of Windows 8, and I crossed the two in my mind.
Okay.
You know, Windows Defender is what it's called for Windows 8, and Microsoft Security Essentials is something that can be installed on any version of Windows that's currently connected to the internet, and they both offer very similar features.
One paid antivirus protection program is Kaspersky Internet Security. What does that do, and what kind of features does it have? Is it expensive? Would you recommend it?
Kaspersky has a pretty similar price range to Norton and McAfee, but where it differs is how it keeps your computer protected. And this is something that I personally recommend to people, but only if they have newer, more powerful machines, because unlike Norton and McAfee, which have services that run at very specific times, Kaspersky is constantly running. It is always getting updates. Anytime that the Kaspersky labs find a new virus, it gets pushed to the Kaspersky software on any computer, and that computer is constantly scanning everything that your computer is doing to keep it protected. The reason that I only recommend this for newer computers with more faster hardware is that because it is always scanning, always doing, always thinking, it uses a lot of resources. So if you have an older machine and you run Kaspersky, you're going to notice that your computer's going to slow down quickly.
And the cost, you said, is very comparable to the Norton?
Yes. Kaspersky, Norton, McAfee, these all have yearly subscriptions. And it's important to understand that you can't just buy it once. When it warns you that you need to update, you have to follow their rules and update. If you're not getting the most up-to-date virus definitions, then you can very easily fall into the same trap as though you didn't have any virus installed at all.
There are reports that Norton has a higher false positive rate or has higher false positive rates than average. What does that mean, and how much of an issue is it?
It's really all about how these different softwares isolate different files to see that they are potentially negative.
Uh-huh.
Norton's file system is designed to look at any file that ends in an executable or ends in a PDF or any of these things that when someone downloads accidentally, they can start running nasty things on the computer. Because of that, Norton's display may not always use the best language. It'll say that it's quarantined, you know, X number of files. But when it's finished that quarantine, when it's finished a more thorough analysis, it'll determine that those files aren't, you know, corrupt or doing nasty things, and so they'll put them back. But it's hard to look at those, you know, the way that they worded it sounds like Norton is constantly capturing bad things on your computer. When you go to look at them, they're not actually that bad. But it's really just the process that Norton, you know, singles those things out is different from how the others do it.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com, we're talking about antivirus software. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We welcome them. There are reports that Norton has, I'm sorry, on the other, I, moving on from Norton, McAfee struggles more than usual with detecting malware in the computer already. Why is that?
So the interesting thing to keep in mind with McAfee is that they've done a lot of stuff to partner with the actual providers. So for a while there, McAfee was part of Comcast. If you had Comcast service, then you also had access to McAfee's antivirus software to install. The benefit to this is that Comcast gave McAfee access to different kinds of internet connections from Comcast's perspective instead of from the customer's perspective. And because of that, it limited the different kinds of files that they could see. Because a lot of times, especially with malware, it's not what gets found, you know, the first time you click something. It's what happens when that thing that you clicked, starts doing things on its own. And that tracks back a little further to the botnet thing that I was talking about earlier. You know, if I click on something and it downloads a file, and that file doesn't do anything for, let's say, 3 days, then there's no reason for McAfee to assume that that file is going to do anything after that 3 days. If that file was actually a program that opens up in 3 days and then starts downloading other things, it's doing the work from the computer. And so McAfee, their software wasn't designed for a while to check that kind of thing out. But as far as I know, they've corrected that kind of thing. And this the weird thing about antivirus software is that it's constantly updating and constantly changing. And these guys, you know, all the different people making viruses every day, and a lot of the stuff isn't even stuff that's being made in the United States. It's being stuff that's being made overseas. There's never a time where the antivirus manufacturers will be ahead of the people making viruses. They will always be one step behind because they don't have a choice.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, thanks. Love the show.
Thank you.
I just purchased an Android smartphone, a Galaxy 3S. And is there any recommendation for antivirus for that, as I know that they've been starting to get hit with viruses recently?
So this is really an interesting thing. If you are a United States citizen and you install updates through the Android market, there are no such thing as viruses for your phone. The thing that you hear about a lot when there are viruses for your phone, there is a feature that Android phones have, and it's in your phone just like it's in my phone, that there is a button that says install applications from unknown sources. If that button is checked, then you run the risk of having, you know, things that do not come from Google's servers installed on your phone. However, if that box is unchecked, which it is by default, then you don't ever have the ability to get viruses on your phone. So having antivirus software, especially if you're going to pay for it, is just not necessary.
Awesome. But why would they even put that button on the phone if they want to ensure the integrity of their operating system?
Well, because it's an open platform, and it's designed so that people who are writing applications and people who are, doing different things with the phones are able to operate flexibly. And that's why that checkbox exists, but it's turned off by default.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
Not a problem.
Russell Holly, we have an email from Paul. He says, perhaps the guest can address browser security. Several free protections are add-ons to browsers like NoScript for the Firefox browser. Thoughts?
Okay, so browser security is kind of a different thing because there are websites that you can go to where even though you haven't clicked anything and you haven't, you know, you haven't really done anything, all you've done is gone to that URL, you are already infected. This happens because there are our browsers have become pretty sophisticated here in 2012, and as a result, things can automatically run from the browser onto your computer. You see this when music starts playing when you go to a website, or when you go to print something, and it allows you to print from your website to the printer. There are a lot of different examples. unfortunately, there are people that have found ways to use that kind of automated thing that we've come to really appreciate and take advantage of to you know, put antivirus things, put malware and viruses on computers. There's not really a sophisticated way to deal with it. The gentleman who wrote the email brought up NoScript, and the problem with NoScript is that it requires technical knowledge that's kind of beyond the average user, in my opinion, to be able to really understand and efficiently use it. Because what happens is when these things go to run automatically, you have to go through and approve each script to run the way that NoScript is designed. It gives you the ability to run a script or not run a script. Unfortunately, it does this through a pop-up. And just like any other pop-up, the average user is going to see it, they're going to read halfway through it, and they're going to click OK, and the script is going to run anyway. Because you don't go to a website to read, 10 warnings. You go to a website to get the information that you want to move on. The unfortunate truth is that most people will just click OK without reading it. And because of that, NoScript ends up not being as effective as it should be, because the thing that's going to infect your computer gets run anyway. There are people at Google, and there are people at Mozilla, and there are people at Microsoft who spend all day, every day, looking for ways to stop these kind of scripts from running automatically by detecting that they are malicious and stopping them, or by giving you a warning before you go to that website that says, this website has got malicious code on it. It's not perfect, but it's something that's constantly being worked on.
Is it true that Macs don't get viruses, or do they need antivirus protection as well, Russell?
So,
are you a Mac user? Are you a Mac user?
I use all.
That's what I thought.
Operating systems currently. I do have a MacBook that I use pretty frequently, but there is no such thing as a computer that can't get a virus. The misnomer that Macs can't get viruses is because Macs are set up so that most, not all, but most things require you to enter a password in order to either install or modify at the system level. And because of that, it's much harder for just a basic application to gain deep level access to your computer and start doing nasty things. However, there have been many, many cases in the past where, thousands and thousands and thousands of Mac computers have become affected. And that is why there are antivirus software solutions for Mac, just like there are for Windows.
Okay, myth put to rest. Russell Holly, thanks for joining us today.
It is not a problem. This has been fun.
We really appreciate it. Russell Holly is a tech blogger for Geek.com. You can listen back to today's shows and every show by visiting WOSU.org/allsides. Explore the All Sides archive, where you can find more information, links, audio, video, and podcasts. Also, be sure to like All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook and follow me, Ann, on Twitter at AnnFisherWOSU. Like to thank my All Sides staff today, Associate Producer Amy Jurovich, All Sides Intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides Production Assistants Rachel Ramey and Leticia Wiggins, All Sides Volunteer Andrew Sweet, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Alan DeCenzo, as I said earlier, is composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.